As part of the Engage at the Bush Center series, presented by NextPoint, Bush Institute's David Rubenstein Fellow Keith Hennessy, Business Roundtable President and COO Kristen Silverberg, and former Deputy Director of the National Economic Council Mark Summerlin led a timely conversation surrounding America's ongoing economic realignment. The conversation was moderated by Cullum Clark, Director of the Bush Institute SMU Economic Growth Initiative. That's up next on Overheard at the Bush Center.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the President and CEO of the George W. Bush Presidential Center, Shiloh Brooks.
All right. How are y'all doing? Welcome to the Bush Center. I'm Shiloh Brooks. It's good to have you here. Welcome to the annual NextPoint Lecture. It's always a highlight for us. And our Engage at the Bush Center series is one of the great events we put on. I want to say how grateful we are to NextPoint for endowing this series and for their continued commitment to fostering meaningful dialogue. Let me give a warm welcome to our guests from NextPoint who are here with us tonight. We're honored by your presence and we're grateful for everything you do for us. We're also pleased to welcome members of our board and our Executive Advisory Council. Thank you guys for your leadership and your support. A special greeting to those of you in our President's Council with us tonight, which is a great giving society. Your generosity obviously makes evenings like this possible. Without you, we couldn't do it. And of course, thank you to President and Mrs. Bush who are here with us tonight. I've said this before, but when I was 17, the president was sworn into office. I watched that ceremony on TV from Lubbock, Texas. And that was one of the first time I realized that somebody from the middle of nowhere like him and me could actually make something of themselves. The verdict is still out on me, but I'd say he did a pretty darn good job. So I've led the Bush Center now for 2 months, and I've been deeply impressed with the dedication of our staff, the enthusiasm I felt for our work in meetings with leaders from Dallas to D.C. They all know I've learned what we know, which is that the Bush Center is a singular educational institution, unique even among its peers, in its capacity to edify lawmakers, the public, future leaders, and young people like the ones here at SMU. I find a lot of inspiration for this work in a lot of places, but nowhere do I find inspiration more deeply than the American founding. I think about the way every day I run the 43rd President's Center, and I look back to the words of the fourth president, who was James Madison. He wrote this in 1822, that knowledge, quote, will forever govern ignorance, and that a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives. Part of our mission here at the Bush Center is to arm people with the undefeatable power of knowledge. So now, to introduce tonight's panel, it's my pleasure to welcome to the stage NextPoint's Chief Communication Officer, Lucy Bannon.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lucy Bannon. I'm the Chief Communications Officer at NextPoint. And on behalf of NextPoint, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the 8th Annual NextPoint Lecture, a signature event here in the Engage series at the Bush Center, which we are proud to have endowed. When we launched this partnership with the Bush Center, we envisioned the NextPoint Lecture as a way to explore the forces driving the global economy and the policies that shape its trajectory. Each year, we gather thought leaders to examine trends, tensions, and opportunities that define our economic landscape. Tonight's panel will dive into some of the most consequential policy issues of our time, from tariffs and trade to the role of government, investment, and private enterprise. We'll explore the evolving dynamics of U.S.-China relations, the future of physical capital, and the resilience of our institutions in a rapidly shifting world. In other words, we have a lot to pack into an hour. Fortunately, we have the right group to do so. We're honored to be joined by three distinguished experts whose insights will guide us through these complex issues. We have Keith Hennessy, who's the David Rubenstein Fellow of the Bush Institute and a lecturer in economics at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He previously served as the director of National Economic Council under President Bush, advising on major economic legislation and leading the administration's response to the 2008 financial crisis. We're also joined by Ambassador Kristen Silverberg, who's the Executive Vice President for Policy at the Business Roundtable, an association of more than 200 CEOs of America's leading companies representing every sector of the U.S. economy. She served as the U.S. Ambassador to the European Union and as Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs. Her distinguished career includes senior roles at the White House and service in Baghdad, for which she received the Secretary of Defense Medal for Outstanding Public Service. Finally, we have Mark Summerlin, who's a managing partner at Everflow Macro, which is a global economic consulting firm. He served as deputy director of the National Economic Council under President George Bush, where he helped shape key legislation, including the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act and the Sarbanes-Oxley Acts. He also played a central role in the economic response to 9/11. And finally, we're fortunate to have our moderator, Cullum Clark, director at the Bush Institute SMU Economic Growth Initiative here, and an adjunct professor of economics at SMU. Cullum leads the Bush Institute's work on domestic and economic policy, and he previously spent 25 years in the investment industry. His research here focuses on economic growth, urban economics, and modern economic history. So let's get started. Please join me in welcoming Keith, Kristen, Mark, and Cullum to the stage.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Bush Center. Our topic tonight is America's economic policies. Now, we've seen really significant shifts in our economic policies since January 2025, since the new administration took office. And some of the areas, of course, include the relationship between the government and private business, tariffs and trade, policies to accelerate how we build things in America, like factories and roads and bridges and homes, the Federal Reserve and monetary policy, and AI and other innovative new technologies. Now, a lot of these changes that we're going to talk about were well underway, actually, I think well before January 2025. But it does seem that this year, in a way that none of us have ever experienced before in our lifetimes, basic questions about how America's economic, our whole economic system works, and how we can best promote prosperity are, in some sense, up for grabs. Now, we at the Bush Center are focused very much on all of these areas. One basic question, of course, is what does it all mean for the American people and for our economy? A second big question is whether we are, in fact, seeing a lasting realignment in the sense of policy changes that are likely to extend beyond the current presidency. And of course, at the Bush Center, we're always very focused on how we can strengthen democratic capitalism and accelerate economic growth, because we do remain convinced that democratic capitalism and the economic growth that it unleashes are the best means of ever devised for improving human well-being and expanding opportunity. We could not be joined by three more well-qualified panelists to address these questions. So, Kristen, Mark, Keith, it is an honor to have you at the Bush Center.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. So, Kristen, let's start with you and with the relationship between the federal government and business. So in the Biden years, we saw a real resurgence in industrial policy, subsidies to semiconductor companies and so forth. And now in the last year, we've seen something totally different, right? Federal government taking an equity interest in Intel and other companies. So what is driving this assertion of federal power in the business sector, and what are the implications?
Well, it is a big shift. You know, for most of U.S. history, in most sectors, the government has operated as a kind of referee. It lays out regulations, enforces contracts, protects competition, but doesn't operate as a direct market participant, as kind of a player on the field. The Biden administration took a step towards a kind of more activist role with industrial policy, as you say, with lots of subsidies and tax credits that are designed, you know, were designed to shore up specific industries. And the Trump administration has taken a further step in that direction with some of these decisions to take equity stakes in particular companies, in some cases by negotiating profit sharing arrangements, mostly around companies that have a particular national security implication. So things like rare earth minerals, semiconductor companies. It's not entirely unprecedented for the U.S. government to take an equity stake in a company. It happened after the financial crisis, but it normally is something that's in response to a crisis, and the government is trying to get out of its position as quickly as possible. It is unusual for the government to take a long-term position. And I think what's driving it is this sense that you know, that we need to be less reliant on China, that we need to shore up our national security by making sure that some of these industries can do business in the U.S. And in individual cases, you can make a defense of them, but as a long-term trend, I think it's really concerning, you know, if you started to see the government playing a broader role, and in part because there's no way that the government, no matter how, you know, effectively bureaucrats are operating, are going to make decisions for the long, you know, as well as the private sector will in terms of how you allocate capital. There's a real risk that you're supporting cronyism. You know, if you're a company and your competitor is held 10% by, you know, by the U.S. government, there's no way you're going to get fair treatment in terms of government contracts or regulations. So we think it's a concerning thing. We're with the Bush Center on democratic capitalism. And to me, that's just so central to where we, to our national DNA. We are, next year, we're going to be celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And we think of that as a political document, but it's also an economic document. It's a rejection of British mercantilism. It's a statement that, you know, the crown was operating too heavily in the economy. And you see that in the Constitution as well. It's the Constitution created this national free trade zone, and it protects contracts. So anyway, we're working with, you know, a lot of people like the Bush Center to just try to remind Americans. I mean, we're in Dallas. I don't have to remind you about free enterprise, but the importance of markets and competition and economic liberty.
Thank you. So, Mark, same topic. Take us inside the mind of this administration. What are people thinking?
We're going to go on a dark journey.
And I'm really curious as to, like, what's the end game here? One day President Trump won't be president and these equity stakes might still be there. Help us understand it.
Well, I mean, they have a lot of ideas, and sometimes they're not good ideas. Sometimes they're good ideas. Sometimes they're good ideas poorly executed. And so with this, they have this idea that they think that we're going to be building wealth for the general public by holding these stakes, and also by making companies that were, you know, maybe failing or what we need. And if we look at, you know, like specific examples, there's some that make sense. So they took equity stake in a rare earth company. That was a company that didn't have the ability to really do it. They put in a price floor. That's what China is holding over our head right now and one of our key vulnerabilities. And so when you use a tool like this, because it has all these negative possibilities, you want to do it where there's a really clear need. And so like an instance like that, it's fine. When you look at another example, U.S. Steel. So U.S. Steel has something called the golden share, which somehow Trump has a veto over whatever happens. And we can see within 3 weeks of having that, that they vetoed a decision in Illinois where U.S. Steel needed to close a plant or a factory or do something, and they just didn't like it. And so we see the interference that's happening already, and that's one of the, you know, the distortions that makes it just, you know, over time doesn't work. And then the most obvious one of all is we're going to have all these stakes, and then a new team's going to come in 4 years or 8 years, and it's going to be total whipsaw for these companies, and they're going to be told, no, you've got to stop doing that and start doing that. And so it's just not, because, you know, the people who are controlling government are not consistent, so the government policy is not going to be consistent. And so it should be, a rare tool where there's a really clear national reason, and, you know, rare earths is one of those. Most of them aren't.
Okay. So, Keith, industrial policy 2020 style, what are the upsides? What are the downsides? I'm probably asking you to stretch on the upsides here, but.
Yeah, it'll be tough on the upsides. So I think a lot of this traces back to China, mm-hmm, as both a reason and then as an excuse. And so in certain cases, obviously the rare earth elements are the one that everyone's watching now. You have to ask yourself, is China a special case? Is there a vulnerability to the United States? Most people immediately go to a national security vulnerability, but there are also economic vulnerabilities. You know, all the auto manufacturing in the United States could have supply chains that are controllable by the CCP, and that can be a serious vulnerability for us. That can then be used to justify, in my view, in some cases, legitimately, interfering in a normal referee function. Problem is, as soon as that's the case, then everyone says, aha, there's some government largesse available. Hi, I'm now a national security interest. I want some of those sweet, sweet chip subsidies. I want some of that industrial policy. From the other side, you have government officials who are coming in and saying, look, more resources that I can control, private resources, especially in a time of tightly constrained government budgets, this is a way for policymakers to have more control of a larger swath of the economy. Having worked in the Bush administration and just my own instincts, you know, I don't want policymakers to be expanding their control over private firms, private capital, or private individuals. And so I think you've got to be very, very cautious about when you do this. I'm actually going to disagree a little bit with Mark. Even if you think that it makes sense to intervene, say, in rare earths, I would be a hard no on using government ownership as a specific tool for that purpose. There are other, the price floor, there are other things that you can look at here. I'm particularly scared, as Kristen was starting off with, on government ownership. Just, it's a slippery slope.
So the flip side, the international side of all this, of course, is around tariffs and trade. And I don't have to tell all of our audience tonight that we have seen a flurry of tariff announcements, the likes of which no living person has ever seen before in this country this year. So, Mark, why don't we start with you on this one? And I guess what I would ask you is to sort of cut through all of the noise. There is clearly a theory here, and the theory seems to be that it is possible, through some mix of policies, to engineer a large increase in the number of well-paying manufacturing jobs, large reshoring, that the people will be better off than they were before. How realistic is this vision?
Yeah, I mean, so they what they think they're doing is by restricting immigration and getting businesses to move back here, that they're going to drive up domestic wages. And that's their theory of the case. So we'll start with tariffs. So tariffs are just a tax, and they put about $300 billion tax on the economy. It's about 1% of GDP. Economy's done exactly what you'd expect. It slowed down. So far what we're seeing is generally slowing the job growth and the type of things you would think. Where the part that is particularly where they're just misguided on is that if you really want to have businesses come here, you have to lower the cost of production. And so we need to make it as cheap as possible for businesses to be here. And the Trump administration is tariffing basic materials like copper and steel and lumber, and they're also tariffing parts. And so it's making it much more expensive to do business here. And that's why we can look at the investment figures, and there's been no increase in investment so far, because they're actually doing a lot of things that are counterintuitive. You know, I would say again, and I guess I'm going to be I'm normally the most conservative. I might be the least conservative on this panel. If they wanted to, if you wanted to do tariffs for the revenue, do it on finished products coming in.
Right.
And so you can do it maybe on the Lexus that's coming in. Don't do it on the parts that GM needs to make a car in the U.S. and don't make it on the lumber that we need to make, houses when we're in the middle of a housing crisis. It's also the weirdest thing about the tariffs is, so we have this fear about things we don't have in the U.S. And so the fear is that we're going to be cut off from them. And they're putting tariffs on those goods right now that are coming in. And so it's like we're making the fear come true by saying we're relying on this good. And so we're going to put on the tariff now, even though there's no production. And for things like copper, the copper mine is not coming from Chile into the U.S., I mean, it's just not going to happen, it's very clumsy, but it's getting revenue, and the danger that they have when I go in and see the Treasury Secretary of the White House, I tell them, you have this tax bill coming in, it's got some very good incentives for next year, and if you kind of do every single day is crazy town on tariffs, none of those incentives are going to take hold. And like, we just need to dial in some certainty at some point and kind of let the economy grow. U.S. economy generally wants to grow, and we should let it happen.
So Kristen, I think Mark's point about, the intermediate goods, the GM imports and so forth, it kind of reminds me of sort of the basic idea I teach in economic history class at SMU. And one big lesson of economic history is whatever the tariff policy is, there's a bunch of winners, there's a bunch of losers, they're all talking their own book. You're in touch with a whole lot of CEOs. So help us break down, like it's not one single unitary effect, right? There's help us understand.
Yeah, completely agree with that. We have 240 members. Some of them are not that trade exposed. They're a bunch of big tech companies that are benefiting from this AI investment boom. They're doing fine, as we've all seen. There are a bunch of companies who are impacted by tariffs, but they've come up with a strategy to manage around. In some cases, pricing. You know, they're raising their prices or maybe they're cutting costs. Those things have real effects on the American people because you're, you know, paying more when you go into, go shopping, or because a company that's cutting costs is probably doing less hiring and less investment. And my sense is, I mean, that's where we're seeing a lot of the impacts right now. We survey our CEOs four times a year on their expectations for sales and their plans for hiring and capital investment. And the last two quarters have been very, very soft on the hiring side. In fact, it's been the first time we've seen two quarters in a row that were that low since 2009. So, you know, it doesn't, if you look at the overall picture, it doesn't look like the U.S. is heading into a recession. But if you just looked at the hiring picture, you would probably have some concerns. For a lot of Americans, it could feel like a recession. And the place I think, you know, the sector I think that's getting, where we're seeing that the most is manufacturing, for all the reasons that Mark mentioned. Most of our inputs are inputs for manufacturing, so manufacturers get hit first. And if you're a manufacturer who's manufacturing for export, you're getting hit by higher costs on your inputs. You're facing lower demand in overseas markets, in part because of the trade war, and so you're sort of getting hit on both sides. So
that's the worst off.
Yeah.
So Keith, you started into China here a moment ago, and I guess the question arises, since so often China is looming in the backdrop of these conversations, I guess the question I really want to raise is, does it make sense to have a China-specific trade policy? Does China warrant something different than every place else?
I think it does, but I think you've asked one of the most important questions for international economic policy, which is China a special case? Should the U.S. have a trade policy, and then should it have a bespoke policy with respect to China, both because of the increasingly adversarial relationship and just because of the size of the economy? So much of the global flows right now are based on the decisions of two men. And what those two men decide, whether they meet at APEC in a week, whether the president carries through with his threat to add another 100% tariff to China, these two individuals are amplifying other elements of uncertainty with tariff policy. So, you know, I have concerns with higher trade barriers and higher tariffs, but the uncertainty itself is an additional economic burden. Let's also remember here that the Constitution doesn't give the tariff power to the president. It gives it to the Congress. The Congress has delegated a lot of that authority to the president. The president is now stretching that authority, and it'll be tested in the Supreme Court, which will add another dimension of uncertainty to this year. But there's the China question here is a hard one. I think it would be hard for any other presidency. If I could make one other point here. Each of us helped present policy recommendations to a president. And I still look at what's going on. I looked at this during the Biden administration, the current administration, and I try to infer the thought process that led to a particular policy decision. That model doesn't always work that well with this current presidency. There's a difference between the president decided X for the following logical reasons, and I can come up with a set of logical reasons that are consistent with what the president decided, right? Those are different. I spent time with my students debating with the president when he rolled out his tariffs in April. The core question, which is, at the end of the day, does the president prioritize tariffs or does he want deals?
Right.
Which is more important? Because if we have it wrong, then we're going to have the wrong model in our head, and we're going to be adding a confusion about what his goals are. I still don't know the answer. I would recommend to you, you know, tomorrow over lunch, debate with your friends, is he principally a tariffs guy or principally a deals guy? Which does he want? And please tell me what the answer is, because I haven't figured it out.
Can I hop in? Because I really think we're learning that answer, because during the campaign, a lot of the discussion about tariffs was about reshoring, but it feels to me like the revenue conversation has been much, much more important, that they're now, you know, the U.S. government is going to take in $300 to $400 billion in revenues from tariffs this year.
Well, it is for Congress, certainly.
For Congress and maybe for the administration as well. I mean, there's a sense of, you know, that $300 and $400 billion is coming out of, you know, U.S. companies. We have lots of companies who will be paying more than $1 billion individually. And in fact, this last week, GM's share price went up because they said they were only going to be paying, you know, $3 to $4 billion instead of $4 to $5 billion. So this really is a very kind of very material. And I have the sense that they're all getting a little bit addicted to the revenues. It's ironic because they just worked really hard to get this corporate tax bill, which had the theory, which I share, that actually the best way to promote growth in the U.S. is to keep our, you know, the cost structure around corporate taxes low and competitive. But I don't know.
But I think it's because the reshoring part's not working, and they're getting the revenue. And so I think they're pivoting towards, it's the only thing that's working on it. So that's, I don't think it's like a strategy.
But my point is that you may be right on what they're thinking, but at the end of the day, it's not what they're thinking. It's only what a singular he thinks. And in any particular case, in the big ones here.
And I also try to help my students understand what you just said, Mark, that in any one situation, either we're bringing in the revenue or we're getting the reshoring. Mm-hmm. You just can't have both. Not in a single situation, right?
Yeah.
Let's move on to another topic that I brought up in the beginning, and that is the idea of building things in the United States. Obviously, that includes building factories, but extending beyond that. There are studies, and I want to start with you, Keith. You and I have talked about this a fair bit over the years. There are studies that show that just to build a mile of highway or a bridge in the United States can cost more than three times as much as in Northern Europe. Surely we can't be happy about that situation. I've had the chance here at the Bush Center to write a fair bit about housing. We don't build enough of that. We seem to have lost some of the knack to do it in a cost-efficient way. So what is standing in the way? Why are we having such a hard time building things?
I think you've got a few things going on. Kristen and her folks do a lot on permitting. So let me talk about different layers of government. You've got federal, state, and in some cases a lot of localities, each trying to assert jurisdiction in a particular area. You have I'm in California, so we have not just NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, but we have the California equivalent. And then we have the towns and cities, we have the county jurisdictions. So you get all of these fightings where everyone has a veto on the building permit. You also have two other processes. One is this idea of citizen voice, which is rather than delegating authority to elected officials to say, you get to decide where we're going to build, we give everyone the ability to throw in a few dozen lawsuits and kill the project or just raise the cost of it via delay. And those things are slowing it down. Kristen's the permitting pro.
Kristen? Well, I mean, we've really focused on this federal permitting process, which is just Byzantine, and, you know, this long, long period of getting permitting approval is compounded by a long period of litigation. But basically, if you set out to invest a dollar in infrastructure, let's just say energy infrastructure, that dollar on average is going to spend about 4.5 years going, you know, through a process before it actually shows up in the economy. So we have a lot of kind of stranded investment that we think could be unleashed if we could make this process make a little more sense. And part of it is just streamlining, keeping the same environmental standards, but streamlining them and putting a limit on when you can file for litigation. There are cases, there was a pipeline in West Virginia that I think took 11 years between the permit process and the litigation. There was a program in California that took 9 years. It just doesn't make sense. The Trump administration has, to their credit, done some regulatory reforms, but this is an area where you really need Congress to act because the administration can't do a lot of things by regulation. And second, you can't really count on it to stick. You know, if you're going to put $1 billion into some big infrastructure project, you want to know not what are the rules going to be tomorrow, but what are they going to be for the next 5 years.
Can I just add one point?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So there's a new big book out on China. Don't ask me the title because I can't remember, so it's going to be embarrassing. But I'll save you, you know, the 500 pages. The conclusion of the book is that under President Xi, every single one of the top party members is an engineer.
Right.
And when you look at the U.S., the majority of Congress is always lawyers. And so the conclusion of the book is they build things and they have no human rights. We have a lot of human rights, and we don't build things. And so there's, you know, so yeah. We might need a few more engineers, and they might need a few more lawyers.
We've selected there. The system.
Yes, yes.
You want to send them our lawyers?
Yeah, maybe.
So,
not you.
One more point here. If you want more of something, you can lower barriers to allow private participants to increase supply where they think it makes sense to do so, and or you can subsidize it.
Mm-hmm.
Washington's instinct is always to subsidize it. We saw this with the CHIPS Act, where the CHIPS Act layered on, here are 15 different new conditions that your new chip fab must meet.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, by the way, if you do all those things, here's some money to go along with it. My instinct, especially in an era of tight budgets, is to say, let's not keep subsidizing things. Let's be lowering the barriers. And that's what all of these things are talking about. You got to lower the barriers to then allow private investment to come in and build.
Well, let's come back to Kristen and what you just said, Keith, because as you say, we like subsidizing. But of course, it's easy to imagine what the reasons might be, right? It's politically attractive to the politician who gets to. So it would be nice if all of this difficulty was just sort of like, we developed a bad plan and the smart people can solve the problem. But we've seen there was an effort, of course, in the Biden years to pass permitting reform. It faced bitter resistance. There's the prominent book now, Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, Abundance, facing really vitriolic attacks against this idea of making it easier to permit. So try to get us through the politics of this. How are we actually going to make it happen?
There's actually a fair amount of bipartisan support for the idea that you have to do permitting reform. The disagreement is over who should benefit from that. The Republicans, not surprisingly, want traditional energy sources really to lean in on that. And the Democrats, not surprisingly, want to see permitting reform principally to accelerate green energy. Our view, BRT's view, is, look, we're going to need all forms of energy. We have, you know, electricity demand in the country has been actually pretty stable for about 20 years, but now we're building these massive data centers, which are huge energy sinks. We may see some onshoring of manufacturing, so our energy demands are going to spike. And the only way we're going to realistically tackle that is if we're leaning into oil, gas, nuclear, hydrogen, wind, solar, all of it, which is something Texas does quite effectively. So anyway, that's our point of view, and we'll be working hard with Congress to try to pass something.
Hope you make some good progress. Let's talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve. Mark, I'd love to go to you on this because you have a lot of experience with it, and the press has reported that you've been involved in this process. So we will soon have a new chair appointed. That person will have a very full slate. We have, just looking, I was yesterday preparing for this, looking at the Fed's dot plot showing an enormous range of opinions among the voting members of the Federal Open Market Committee about what's going to happen over the next couple of years, obviously. And then you have this political dynamic. So help us to understand what's happening. What does it look like for the next year?
Yeah, no, I mean, so a lot's happening. So I was one of the 10 people that was interviewed for Fed Chair. So the first question is, like, why would you do it? Which is a very good question. my wife cried when the list came out. And so for me, it's really mission critical to the world. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that they're going to carve it out. And so, you have to throw your hat in if you're willing to, if you think you can do a good job and you know you're going to be independent. That's also why my betting odds are rounding to zero right now. And so
0.3%.
Okay, zero. Yeah.
It's a good buy.
I found the only person who's ever bought my contract.
Pretty good.
So, which is, so I think I owe money now. But no, it was, you know, it was, it's a very interesting time. So, you know, my interview was, you know, over 2 hours with the Treasury Secretary. It was around the world. It was, you know, it was very serious. I was thinking as we were doing the museum tour today that it could easily be like a decision point. And so if we think about the decision before the Fed chair right now, you can see the unemployment rate's been rising steadily for about 2 years. So interest rates are a little too high from that perspective. And if you roll out an economy in recession, in the best case scenario, it takes 4 years to recover those jobs. And so it's easy to be really tough when you don't have the decision yourself, but you have to be very careful when we're in a situation like right now where job growth is going down to zero. On the other hand, and there are one other reason why lower rates might help is we're in this, you know, this AI race, which is really a power race. We need to build as much power as we can. We have a lot of construction to do. Lower rates would help with that, like, kind of central mission. The flip side is, you know, we're in the start of kind of a, you know, valuation bubble that's probably moving into a credit bubble. And so from that perspective, you'd want to have tighter policy to prevent us from forming a bubble that's going to pop and do. And so that's like literally what the decision point would be in the little computer down there. And so, you know, for me, it's Trump policy has created a really weird fiscal path. Tax hikes this year, tax cuts next year. I would have, you know, publicly I was saying the Fed was about 50 basis points too tight. I don't have a problem with lowering rates now to keep us from rolling into recession, knowing that I might be raising them in a year. And the volatility that you might get from that is just, it's not caused by the Fed. It's caused by the administration policies that are kind of whipsawing things around. I think the for you know people in that care about markets and other things, my own guess is that as the Supreme Court has made it clear that the Fed is going to be the exception, meaning still being independent, that changes the president's reaction function, that it's more likely the pick choice from the 10 of us is getting rapidly narrowed to the three people that he knows well. And I think the way that you overlie the Supreme Court saying the Fed is independent is by picking someone who may not be independent. So that would be my my concern.
And so the betting odds are high for
Kevin Hassett.
Yes.
So I like Kevin Hassett, but he's he works for the president. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. But it's a big deal. The Fed and the Fed structure is very weird. It's seven people are the board. And then out of the 19, and then we have regional banks like we have in Dallas here that get votes and everything. But if you get control of the board, that seven person, you have the constitutional right to fire the regional bank presidents. And then the Fed chair has veto power of who comes on as a regional bank president. And so you just need four out of seven. You don't need to control the whole thing to start, you know, giving power. And for real Fed nerds, which I know includes you, in the system where we move from Fed funds rate to interest on reserve balances, it's actually only interest rate is controlled by the seven people,
right,
and not by the whole FOMC. And so when you see a Fed release, it will say the Federal Reserve Board voted to do this, not the FOMC, which is very weird. So with four people of the seven in D.C., you could start lowering rates.
Right.
And so there's some big... there's some big things that can be happening, so it's a pretty important deal. Hopefully, the Senate will, if the person looks like they're going to not be independent, that the Senate would do its job on confirmation and maybe push back on that. But
let me ask a little bit of a speculative question, a little further out, that I think relates to the Fed, Mark. It's something we've written about here at the Bush Center. I think that there's been growing attention as we, in effect, fail to address our spiraling federal budget deficits.
Yeah.
Growing attention to what, I'll nerd out here for a moment for anyone, the fiscal theory of the price level. The idea that if Congress runs huge rising deficits essentially forever into the future, that people will ultimately conclude that we're going to be paying for that through more rapid money printing, for lack of a better word, that that's inflationary, that we'd be looking at a more inflationary world, not just next year, but kind of going out, because there's no credible plan to address it. How do you think about that?
Yeah. So fiscal policies clearly has a huge impact on inflation. It's very obvious that it was the 2021 Recovery Act that caused the inflation spike. We had COVID. We had a year of inflation falling. The Ukraine war started a year after the acceleration, and the acceleration inflation started, you know, by 2 months after the economic recovery bill passed. And when you're trying to figure out, and people are like, well, we did all this other spending during COVID, and it's like calories. And so, like, if I decide to eat 4,000 calories today, it's not the first 2,000 that's going to make me put on weight tomorrow. It's the last 2,000. And the Congress had done enough. And then for political reasons, the new administration felt they had to come in and do it all over again. And we got, we got clear inflationary pressure coming from that. I personally am an old-fashioned kind of supply and demand, and we just had way too much demand in the economy. I worry a little bit less about inflation expectations channel, which is part of the fiscal theory that you're talking about. Yeah. But we are, it's no way to run a railroad, what we're doing now. I can get a fiscal crisis in maybe like 2032, 2033, but that's 8 years. For our kids, that matters a lot. And so, we definitely need, if you ask me one thing we could do, what I could do for policy-wise, macro, would be like cut the deficit in half and then we could lower rates and do other things. Yeah.
Agreed. Well, I think everybody out there is thinking about AI a lot. Let's talk about AI. And I think maybe a way to set this up is to sort of highlight some of the big issues and sort of make it multiple choice. I mean, I think everyone has their thoughts on it, but just to name some of the big issues. How can we sensibly, and let's start with you, Keith, but how can we sensibly regulate AI without strangling the baby, as it were, without sort of preventing all the good that might happen from occurring? Then there is the issue of how can we, in effect, create enough power to actually satisfy the voracious demand of AI? Then you have the job market implications. New York Times had an article just yesterday on Amazon saying, 500,000 people they won't hire because of AI, they maybe think. And then, of course, you have the near-term question, are we actually investing too much in data centers? Is it a bubble that when it bursts, we'll find, well, nothing else was really growing, so the economy is going to be in trouble. So wherever you'd like to take it, and let's see where the conversation
goes.
Yeah.
My favorite line about this is that kudos to the linear algebra crowd for the best rebranding ever.
Right.
And if we were calling these LLMs and large language models, there would be 1/1,000th of the hype. AI is a sexy term. It conjures all the Terminator movies and all of the fun imaginary robot future type images. Artificial large language models are not actually intelligent. They don't know. There's no sense of understanding of what it's saying. It is Google autocomplete on steroids. Now, it is, a lot of steroids, and it's very good at it. But it reminds me of my MBA student when I cold call him, and he's just really good at BSing, and he gives a very plausible sounding answer. And I can tell that he clearly hasn't done the reading. But because he's so good at pattern recognition and he's so good in speaking in certain ways, the rest of the class is saying, okay, yeah, this sounds good. That's what LLMs are producing. They're very good at seeming smart, which is different than being smart.
And some Stanford Business School students are apparently also good at
that. I see this, take sort of the labor market aspects of this. I see this in the classroom. Each of us had to write a lot of memos to the president. And so a core element of what I try and teach my students is how to write a short, clear, effective memo for a principal. students universally come back years later and they say, thank you for making me write all those darn memos. If you're good at using these tools, you can use an LLM as a productivity-enhancing tool. You can produce much more thorough, really high-quality content if you use it to amplify your own thinking and to amplify your own work. Or you can use it as a substitute for your own thinking, in which case you're going to get what sometimes gets labeled as AI slop. For people in thinking professions, I can't yet figure out how to do this. How do I get my students to learn to use this tool to make themselves more effective and more productive? And to the extent that we're doing that out in the world, it's just going to be a productivity-enhancing tool, and it's going to be good. If instead we start to use it as a substitute for people in thinking professions, it's going to be a real problem.
Right. Substitute away from our brains, in effect. So, Kristen, what's top of mind for you when you think about this technological revolution?
I don't know. I mean, we spend time on lots of pieces of it, on the regulatory piece and the need for some kind of federal preemption. There's too much of a patchwork of AI regulatory policies across the country. We spend a lot of time on the energy piece I mentioned earlier. But the thing that we really want to understand and don't yet is the workforce piece. We have some companies who are big AI developers, like Google or Meta or Microsoft, and obviously they are very deep on AI. And we have some companies who are part of building out the infrastructure, like Bechtel, that builds data centers. But most of our members are just big companies who will use AI in some way to enhance productivity. And I don't think they can tell you, any of them really can tell you what it's going to mean for their workforce. They're investing a lot, they're experimenting, but I just don't think they have any sense of kind of what that really is going to mean 5 years from now in terms of what their workers are doing, how many workers they have, et cetera. So to me, in a time of this massive uncertainty, you just have to, the only thing you can do is go back to fundamentals. One piece of fundamental is our K-12 education system. I mean, someday another president is going to run on K-12, and I'll support him too, because it's what could we do that could be more important than having a good education system. Part of it is making sure that workers have lots and lots of paths to getting retrained throughout their career. We spend a lot of time on supporting work-based learning, apprenticeships, and other things, and just making sure that we have a, you know, resilient and adaptable economy.
Mark, so economic implications, first of all?
Yeah, well, there's a book called The Coming Wave by Suleiman, who's Google's AI person. And it's a little bit scary because the premise of the book is that within 10 years, we're going to have AI hooked up to robots, hooked up to quantum and possibly nuclear power. And if we have AI with the ability to move in unlimited energy, no one on the planet can imagine what that is. And so that's both, you know, frightening and invigorating, depending on, you know, your view of things. But it's a little scary that we're going down a road where we just don't even know what that, we don't know what that means. You know, for the, you know, for the economy, I'll just make two points. So over the last year, U.S. economy has created $10 trillion of wealth. That is a crazy number. We tend to spend about 5 cents out of every dollar of wealth that we get. And so AI is adding about $500 billion a year to consumer spending. And so without the AI stock market boom, we could have had a recession in either 23 when the Fed was really tight, or we could have had one this year. And so we have this elevated stock market that is really carrying us through and also concealing some of these other economic issues that we have. And so you don't like to have an economy that's running on kind of one leg. You know, you'd like it to be broader. The other point I would say is, you know, we are in a power race with China. Mm-hmm. I'm generally not, you know, most people are like all of the above. I don't really like that because it means we subsidize everything. And just as like an intellectual exercise, we could take the whole needed increase in electricity that we need over the next rest of the decade. And for $1 trillion in a world of no regulations, you could do it with next generation nuclear power. And so in the U.S., we throw trillions of, you know, these bills. We do $2-3 trillion bills all the time. If we had a really, you know, in a perfect world where you were king and we didn't have Congress, we didn't have regulations, we could do it. We know how to do it. And so it would be nice to actually backward solve the problem. And if, you know, people might have other ideas than what I see. But China is building, you know, they've got, you know, 79 nuclear power plants under construction. They've got coal plants going back online. And the thing about AI is, like, even if we don't want it, we don't get that choice because China is building it. Right. And so we can't, you know, we can't really cede the race. And so we maybe the right answer is none of us should be doing it. But maybe Keith will be right. Keith? It's not, they won't do anything. So it'd be good.
Can I hit your regulatory point?
Yeah, please.
The U.S. economy has, with all of our problems, has significantly outpaced Europe since COVID.
Yeah.
We have a major structural advantage over the European economies and over China in the way the philosophy that we use to regulate new technologies, which is don't. Mm-hmm. Right? It gets out there. People, I'm in Silicon Valley, they're out there inventing all kinds of crazy things, right? And then eventually some of these things that they invent start to cause serious harm. And then policy does, and I would argue should, come in and say, okay, you're creating a really harmful side effect here. We're not going to let you do that. You have to do X, you can't do Y. We're seeing this, so we saw this with the internet. The internet was largely unregulated for 20, 25 years, and it just exploded and added all sorts of value. We are now very well aware of what some of the side effects and some of the problems are, and so it's appropriate to come in and say, here's a targeted problem here, let's use policy to fix it, here's another one here. To their credit, tremendous credit, both the Biden and the Trump administration took this same approach for self-driving cars. They said, we're not going to be overly prescriptive. You guys go develop new things. And then if we have to, we'll then intervene. And as a result, all the good self-driving car work is being done here rather than in Europe. The Europeans take the precautionary principle as their concept, which is if you come up with something new, before you sell it, you have to go ask the government for permission. That massively slows their innovation. For something like this, we need to just stick to our knitting, mm-hmm. let the things get out there, and when there's harm's done, then you come in and you target the regulatory solutions. Don't make people go through a government gate to develop some new technology.
Kristen, really quickly, I think Keith talked about some upside case. I mean, the internet, we did see a notable re-acceleration in productivity growth. Do you see a good upside case? Might we actually experience a sustained boom because of productivity gains?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reason so much investment is going into it now is because somebody, you know, there's going to be real productivity upside. I don't know that every investment is going to pan out. I mean, some won't. But on the whole, you know, this is going to be a really important change for the U.S. economy. So anyway, I don't spend any time worrying about the investors and this, you know, potentially bursting bubble. I spend a lot of time worrying about the point I talked about earlier, which right. is what is this going to mean for the U.S. worker and how do we help them navigate it?
How do we train them for it?
Yeah.
We are sadly running low in time. Let me, before we close our program, note a few business items for everyone here. So first item business is to, again, thank our friends, Lucy Bannon, Jim Dondero, and all our friends at Next Point for endowing the Engage at the Bush Center Series. Thank you very much. We have some great programs coming up. Our next Engage program on November 13th marks the return to the Bush Center of the pioneer woman, Ree Drummond, in conversation with her daughters, Alex and Paige. Then on November 18th, Deck the Halls will offer a behind-the-scenes look at holiday traditions at the White House from former staff members who helped bring them to life. And please join us also on December 5th for a festive evening at our annual Merry and Bright Night with holiday fun for the entire family. Register at bushcenter.org, and remember, it's free for our members. So before we stop, I, of course, want to say thank you to Keith Hennessy, Kristen Silverberg, and Mark Summerlin for a really interesting conversation. I thought I might, I always think it's fun to have a very quick lightning round. I had just a couple quick questions I wanted to ask you. Really quick, okay? For all the young people out there, and my 22-year-old daughter is here, I always like to ask very quickly, headline advice to, that you give to young adults today. Mark.
Read.
Read. Okay. Thank you for the one word. I agree. Mark.
Take risk before you have a house and family.
Choose your first bosses very carefully. You've got to work with people with decency and integrity because their work habits and their reputation and everything else will affect you for a long time to come.
So however you want to do it, 0 to 10, how optimistic are you on the 5 to 10-year view U.S. economy, Keith?
I want to go last. I need to think about that.
Mark?
I would say 7.
Pretty good.
I work for a bunch of optimists, so I'll go with 8.
Ooh. Yeah, I'll go 8.
So we got plenty of challenges, but it looks actually pretty good. And lastly, one great thing that you're reading that has to do with economics or business?
I'm reading about falsifying preferences, when people will say something that they don't actually believe to try to fit in socially.
Interesting. Who wrote it?
I'll get back to you on that.
Please do. Mark?
I'm reading a book called From Good to Great by Jim Collins. It's kind of like a classic. As someone who runs a business that is good and not great, the first sentence is, and it was, good is the enemy of the great. And I was like, ooh, that hurts. Right.
Kristen?
I'm reading a bunch of articles recently, mostly about this question of state capitalism and the history of kind of our own economic system.
We are clearly in a very tumultuous time, a whole lot of news, a lot of things to make sense of. I think you all have cut through all of that and helped us understand the major issues very, very well. And it's nice to hear that when it's all said and done, you are actually optimistic, and so am I. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Keith, Mark, and Kristen. Many, many thanks to all of you all for joining us at the Bush Center this evening. Enjoy the beautiful fall weather in Dallas. It doesn't last long, and have a good night.
Thank you for tuning into that conversation. To learn more about the Bush Institute SMU Economic Growth Initiative, visit www.bushcenter.org/economicgrowth.